Remember when your grandma watched The Member Drive on PBS and joined so she could get that sweet Peter, Paul, and Mary concert on VHS? Now you can do the same thing with the Pop Culture Preservation Society. Each of our episodes is created with the help of listeners like you, and you can become a financial supporter of the PCPS over on patreon.com to help us pay the bills and keep doing what we love. To show our appreciation, we'll send you welcome gifts and give you access to bonus content, like video recordings of our episodes, after-the-episode discussions, and blooper reels from the cutting room floor. Just go to patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, type Pop Culture Preservation Society into the search bubble, and choose the level of support that feels right for you. And if you're not able to contribute at this time, remember that listening is the most important form of support you could ever give. Thank you.
It wouldn't have had the same impact, maybe, that it's having right now, because at least for us, you know, we'll go on and on about Gen X, but to be the age I am now, the adult I am, and going back and looking at this, and also, and I'll talk about this in a little while, the state of our country right now and the world where we are, to have this come out and remind us
we are
the world.
No, and that's really smart. You're right. Yeah.
Hello world, is a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
We had a dream. Welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the Big Wheel generation who can see a photo of Love's Baby Soft and still smell it.
We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear, like Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
And today, we'll be saving the story behind that compulsively singable song that made a brighter day for so many. We Are the World.
I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle. And we are your pop culture preservationists. After Band-Aid released that other compulsively and heartbreaking singable song, in December of 1984, Harry Belafonte decided to create an American benefit single for African famine relief, specifically in Ethiopia, as well as for hunger relief in the United States. We Are the World was recorded in January of 1985 and released just 2 months later in March. It topped music charts throughout the world and became the fastest-selling U.S. pop single in history. With sales in excess of 20 million copies, it is the ninth best-selling physical single of all time, certified quadruple platinum, and its awards include 4 Grammys, 1 American Music Award, and a People's Choice Award. Thank you, Wikipedia. What are your memories of this? Do you guys remember singing it and the story behind it, or...
Not. I remember no story whatsoever.
No.
I remember the song as just being ubiquitous. And so that made it kind of like a gnat flying around my head because it was everywhere. It was everywhere on the radio all the time. And I didn't dislike the song by any means, but I don't think I gave it another thought because it was so ubiquitous.
Yeah. I remember very specifically feeling like, this is so cool. Like, owning kind of the USA for Africa part. Like, I loved, I still have my big EP of Do They Know It's Christmas. I mean, you guys know I was all about the British invasion artists of 1983, 84. But I can remember kind of feeling, I don't know, kind of pride in that ownership of, this is USA for Africa. This is, now we did it too. Like,
with a cowboy hat.
Yeah. And when I say singable, I think I had forgotten how singable until we watched this documentary
I can't stop singing it. even today, getting ready for this episode, I was humming along and singing along. My memories of the song are directly related, I think, to the video. Like, when I hear that song, I can see the music video in my head. I could tell you the mannerisms that people had during it. Yeah, so the video is what really... stays in my mind in terms of what I remember when it came
out. And that sweatshirt Diana Ross is wearing, that stayed in my mind too. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can find those. I bet you can. I bet people have remade
them. That would be such a throwback. Can you imagine like going for a walk and seeing somebody with that sweatshirt on?
And it's such a sign of 1985. They're all like XXLs.
It's huge.
They're huge sweatshirts.
Yeah, so you would like come down to your thighs. Mm-hmm. Remember, you'd wear your sweatshirts. Like they were like quadruple X's.
Yeah. Well, there's so much more to this story than we knew. And just this past January, 39 years later, Netflix shared the story behind the magical night recording We Are the World in a truly fascinating documentary called The Greatest Night in Pop. And it is a story, you guys. It is one that comes with conflict and plot twists, tone, and at times way too many main characters.
right.
And that's what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be kind of sharing our own take on some of these stories and some of the just behind the scenes nuggets that we had no idea were
so
happening.
So many nuggets.
Oh my gosh, too many for us to talk about. Mm-hmm. So again, we're going to say a million times, watch it. But this is going to be super fun. So as the documentary begins, you hear Lionel Richie, who kind of narrates us through and takes us through this whole story. You hear his voice tell us, the greatest artists of a generation came together with all of our ego, with all of our talent to save some lives. There was nothing more chaotic than trying to rope this creative ball of energy together. This was history happening right now.
So who knew that watching a documentary about the making of We Are the World would solidify my faith in a higher power? You guys, here we are.
Oh my God.
Okay.
What?
Well, listen, as we talk about it today, as we reflect on this documentary, we learned so many things that had to happen at just the right moment.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah, that's true.
The stars had to align, figuratively and literally. And you will have no doubt by the end of our conversation, and for sure watching this documentary, that the universe most definitely orchestrated this amazing moment in pop culture history. I would put my life on it.
That is a really interesting take, Carolyn. Yeah.
Yeah, just the timing and
the sliding
we'll talk
doors.
About it.
So many sliding doors.
There comes a time when we heed a certain call, when the world must come together as one.
All right, so let's get into it. Let's get into the story.
Yes.
So the seed of We Are the World took place in the office of a talent manager named Ken Cragen. His employees said that they were summoned to a mandatory meeting with no information given. They had no idea what was happening, but they knew it was big. And that was confirmed when they walked in and saw Ken Cragen seated next to Harry Belafonte. Harry Belafonte was an elder statesman of the music industry. He wasn't on the charts anymore, but he was universally beloved, and he was also very well known as an activist, especially during the civil rights movement. He was outspoken and worked side by side with Dr. Martin Luther King, and at this stage of his activism, he felt that poverty was a civil rights issue, and he thought it was being overlooked, especially in Africa, which, frankly, he thought it's just too far away for people to care about. Mm-hmm. He was also famous for recruiting fellow artists to his causes, and he used his celebrity in service of the greater good, even saying at MLK's March in Washington in 1963, artists have a valuable function in any society since it is the artist who reveals the society itself. So now I'm starting to understand Harry Belafonte as, oh no, he just uses his persona as an entertainer to achieve a higher good, right?
Free to be you and me,
right?
It's free to be you and me. Yeah, that's exactly right. So that's why he was in Ken Cragen's office that day. He was inspired by the success of Live Aid, and he wanted to do a live concert to help feed people in Africa. And the first person he wanted to call was Lionel Richie. Why? Why Lionel Richie? Lionel was at the top of the charts. He was Ken Cragen's client, and he was Black. And Harry Belafonte said to him, we have white people saving Black people, but we don't have Black people saving Black people.
Right.
That is a problem. We need to save our own people from hunger. And he, of course, was not speaking of Black people in their communities. Of course, he was talking about the famous faces out there working for a cause. And he wanted to gather Black people from the entertainment industry to save their own people. And duh, I never noticed that. But when we start to talk about the people that are on this song, it will be obvious that there is more of a cause going on with the cause, sure, which is very admirable. Mm-hmm. So in that meeting, the concert is turned into a single. Lionel Richie says yes, and he knows the perfect person to make this single happen. He says, let's call Quincy. He's talking, of course, about Quincy Jones. And in a history-making move, Quincy says, I'm seeing Michael tomorrow.
I know, exactly.
I'll see just what offhand. He thinks. That Michael was.
That's the universe, by the way.
That's the universe. Yeah. Who is this Michael we're talking about? Michael Jackson. And Thriller was dominating the culture at this moment. The other person Quincy thinks needs to be in that room is Stevie Wonder. Stevie says yes, but never calls them back. Yeah. And this will be the first time that Stevie Wonder will gum up the works on this. So the clock is ticking.
So originally, Quincy Jones was hoping that Stevie Wonder, like you said, Kristen, would be a part of writing the song. But as you also told us, he won't return any phone calls.
Rude
is that? That is
rude.
Yes. And Lionel even says, like, Stevie calls you back. Basically, when Stevie calls you back, it's on Stevie time. Mm-hmm. So it becomes Michael Jackson and Lionel who are going to write this song. So Lionel gets in his car and he heads over to Michael Jackson's house, which we can imagine is just what we think. And even,
And it's, you guys in this documentary, you see it. They had cameras in there.
The camera footage and audio throughout this documentary that they have of things happening in real time then, it's just crazy. It's amazing.
And why did it take 39 years for us to see it?
Yes, I agree.
Well, where's it been?
I don't know, but at the same time, I think that it wouldn't have had the same impact maybe that it's having right now because at least for us, you know, we'll go on and on about Gen X, but to be the age I am now, the adult I am and going back and looking at this and also, and I'll talk about this in a little while, the state of our country right now and the world where we are, to have this come out and remind us the world.
No,
and
that's really smart.
I think
you're right.
There's some deeper part. So who knows? So yes, so we have footage of Michael Jackson's home. We have audio of their going back and forth, Lionel and Michael talking about the song and coming up with the lyrics and the music. And what's interesting, and Lionel talks about this in the documentary, is at first there's really no sense of urgency for this. They're kind of goofing off. Lionel's working on some of his stuff, Michael on his. Michael's hanging out with his menagerie of animals, which Lionel is not super fond of. So Michael is encouraging Lionel to hold Bubbles, the chimp. You guys all remember Bubbles?
But that was that was like so organic, right?
It was, right.
Like, because he's like, actually, no, I'm not holding your chimp.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, no.
I just love this kind of info, though. This is what I'm here for, you guys, because like we see in Tiger Beat, we see in all these magazines, Bubbles the chimp. But now we know that when Lionel Richie was in his home, away from cameras, away from, I'm taking Bubbles on the red carpet, away from, there's no photo. Bubbles, it was truly like.
Bubbles is real.
And like at one point, wasn't there a fight between Bubbles and another animal in the kitchen?
No, it was the mina bird and the dog.
And the dog.
Yeah, because Lionel hears people fighting downstairs and he's very concerned. And Michael's like, no, it's just the mina bird fighting with the dog.
The mina bird. Right. Isn't that like a rare, like only a bird you see?
Probably.
like an endangered species.
Yes. I'm sure.
And I just have this image of the chimp trying to like, crawl into Lionel Richie's lap. And he's like, no, I don't want to hold your chimp.
Oh, God. Well, I think that things might have gotten a little more serious when they found out from Ken Cragen that, oh, by the way, we need to record this song in 10 days. And there are going to be a lot of people involved in this. This is going to be a star-studded spectacular. So chop, chop, chop. We need this. And Quincy's like, I need this now. So all of a sudden we're in kind of, okay, get to it mode, which I read in an article. This isn't in the documentary, but I loved hearing it. Was the Lionel said, that's how he works best. He said his ADD or ADHD that he has works so much better when he's under the gun. So that's when everything's firing. And he said that's kind of when the magic started happening. He said they became possessed. They were going back and forth. It just kind of spilled out of them. So much so that at one point they're singing and they're like, this is it, and humming along. And then Lionel hears this sound coming from somewhere else, kind of like a, like this heavy breathing.
Yes. Oh my God.
And he looks over and lo and behold, Michael's boa constrictor, who had been hiding, Michael hadn't been able to find the boa, emerges when he hears this melodic tune. And Michael was like, this has to be it. Like, yes. Look, the snake is
found the snake.
He wants to say hi to you, Lionel.
And Lionel is like, and you're right, Carolyn. It's so funny. Michael's like, oh, there you are. I've been missing you. Can you imagine?
No,
I cannot. By the way, I've been missing my boa constrictor.
Yes, but he's emerged when we have kind of putting the finishing touches on this masterpiece.
I mean, it's like the men with the pipes and the basket and the cobras come up. That's
exactly Can you imagine letting someone into your home when you don't know where your boa constrictor is?
Oh my God, you guys, I have goosebumps on goosebumps right now, and not in a good nipple lightning way.
And you should be like, I'm sorry you can't come in today. I don't know where the snake
is. But that wouldn't be Michael Jackson. No. But you know what is so interesting? We learned from Lionel that he and Michael go back a ways. They go back to their Motown days. Yeah. They both fronted their, you know, bands and all that kind of thing. And he shares the fact that when Michael Jackson first got his driver's license, the first place that Michael Jackson drove was to Lionel Richie's house. I find this interesting because Lionel says, Michael was too afraid to drive on the highway, so he knew the back roads of how to get to Lionel's house and all through L.A. So the funny juxtaposition of this is I can have a boa constrictor roaming free in my home, a chimp, let's hope he has all of his shots, some rare bird, this dog. I live freely like that, but I can't drive on an L.A. highway.
Exactly. Well, I think we all know Michael Jackson. You know, he has quirks. He's an interesting fellow, right? Yeah. You guys, I have to ask you a question. Mm-hmm. And I think, Carolyn, the scene you just described of Lionel going to Michael's home and just hearing Lionel today talk about these experiences and these times, did you guys get just a different type of respect and appreciation for Lionel Richie?
That
I know I did.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
I love the way he still talks with so much respect about not just all these people involved, but the process of it.
Yes.
And he was like the dad of We Are the World.
Yeah. I mean, Quincy had a different type of role. And when we talk about the recording coming up, we're going to talk about how Lionel had to be more the teacher while Quincy was the principal, right? But, I mean, we all love Lionel Richie. We knew that. But I don't know. I don't know that I knew. When you watch this documentary, listeners, you're going to get a different insight to his character and who he is. And I loved that.
Agreed.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, he's a genius. And he recognized I guess I'm getting a little woo-woo here in my universe stuff, but he recognized how special this was and how serendipitous some of these moments were when they were kind of happening, at least as he reflects on it. And I just thought, I'm going to watch American Idol with a different through a different lens now. He used to kind of annoy me as a judge.
I don't even watch it, but now I want to.
Yeah, not anymore. I am fascinated with him. Well, here's what's amazing. So, you know, they finish writing it. Yay. Okay. Because Quincy's like, you better get it to me. We have 8 days before recording. They get it to Quincy. They do a quick like cassette recording, get it to him. And what's so cool, and I'm not going to spoil it, we have the actual audio of Quincy in this documentary telling someone how he felt when he heard it and it for the first time. And it's, again, you're like, the universe, because that's kind of what he felt like. All right. So he says, yes, let's go with it. We've got to put a demo together really quick. We have to get 40 cassettes out, which they do, to the artists who are going to be singing on this. That happens 4 days before the recording.
Yeah, it's crazy. And if you back up just a little bit, who are we going to send these cassettes to, right?
Right.
So now they need to start getting artists on board, which, as you can imagine, could just be a logistical nightmare. But Lionel Richie was hosting the American Music Awards on January 28th, 1985, which back then the AMAs were a huge deal, much bigger than they are now. And they knew that the event, the AMAs, is going to bring all the top artists to LA. So they think, well, let's find out who's coming, who's going to be here, and who can sell the most records, which I think is so interesting because that obviously meant they had to make choices because some of these stars were just starting out. Some of these artists were just starting out in 1985, you guys. And today, 39 years later, we're like, how could you choose, you know, between this one and this one? So naturally, they start there. Who's going to be there? But one of the first people they really wanted was Bruce Springsteen, because this is 1985. And in 1985, Bruce Springsteen is top of the world. And I love this documentary because we see present day Bruce Springsteen, who still looks so good, come in his cowboy boots. And those are his words. In 1985, I was top of the world. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He's finishing his Born in the USA tour the night before. So he's finishing that tour on January 27th. And I guess he had this rule that he doesn't fly the day after a concert. I mean, a day after a tour ends. But he agreed because, in his words again, he says famine relief was super important to him. And so he's like, I'm in. So now they all think, we've got Springsteen, we could call Bob Dylan. And now it basically becomes a wish list. So we start getting on board people like Billy Joel, Willie Nelson, Tina Turner, Diana Ross, Kenny Loggins, Smokey Robinson. They are all agreeing to do this. And don't forget, they've already got Michael and Lionel, Harry and Stevie. It's truly becoming like a 1984 Music Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was incredible. And they're going through that list of who's going to be in town too for the AMAs. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that that event is happening, I'm sorry, I'll make it sound like angels. We are getting all of these artists in one place at one time, which, you know, happened only a couple times a year.
And the fact that they choose between Madonna and Cyndi Lauper makes 2024 me just, my jaw just drops open. Know. How do you choose between Madonna and Cyndi Lauper? Yes.
And at the time, they might have felt equal. But over time, that's not, and I don't want to minimize Cyndi Lauper by any means. No. She's had a flourishing career, but she didn't become the queen of pop, right?
Right.
Exactly.
What I still don't understand, to this day, I wondered it then. I thought I was going to get the answer when I watched the documentary, and I did not get the answer. Why is Dan Aykroyd on that recording? What? And why is he there?
And why is he one of the first people, at least in the documentary, Kristen, he's one of the first people that they say, so-and-so knew she wanted Dan Aykroyd.
Yes! And I'm like, why? But why? Why do you want Dan Aykroyd? She never says.
But wasn't he a Blues Brother?
Yeah, but yes, still.
He was on the charts. I mean, weren't they maybe on the
vote? That's not, was well, that not right. vocalist though?
Like, and do you hold John him Belushi? Up against?
Yeah, exactly. And do well, you hold true. Him up at the same level
no, you're
of
right.
I mean, a Billy
Bob
Joel,
Dylan?
A Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, Michael
Dan
Jackson,
Aykroyd, Jake yeah. and Elroy?
But
Jake and Elroy don't belong in the room.
It made it fun. It's the ultimate crossover now of, you know, we've got Ghostbusters and all of that. We have all these people in the room. Mm. Yeah.
I just wondered at the time, too, did the people in the room also go, why is Dan Aykroyd here? Why is the Ghostbuster here?
There's probably more to that story. You're right, Kristen. There's probably something we don't know. Like, Dan Aykroyd had something on somebody. Yeah. Like, if you don't put me in this video, I'm going to expose your whatever. Or
like what? Especially because they did not edit out. They included in the documentary the woman saying, and I really wanted Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah, that's, well, maybe that's...
Yes.
Why? Maybe that's the answer. Like, for people that want to know why, it's because this woman who worked there really wanted him.
I feel like it's about the same level as me being in the room and going, and I really want Captain Kangaroo.
Yes, like, right. It's right.
It's a joke almost.
He doesn't have any talent. That's not what we're saying. Mm. He's not a pop star. He's a comedic actor. It's not the same thing.
You guys, it's so funny, though. You're right. We're going to talk in a minute about how these are top-notch stars, and even they started getting really vulnerable and kind of looking around like, I'm not worthy, I'm not worthy. How do you think Dan Aykroyd must have been?
I looked at his face, and it did look a little bit like, shit, where's the back door? So it's now 4 days until the recording, and that's when Stevie Wonder shows up, and he's like, I'm here, let's write a song.
Totally, though.
Yes, and they're like, dude, too little, too late. We are recording the demo to send to the artist today. Poor Stevie is confused. He's not sure what he's supposed to do. Somehow he's able to participate in the making of the demo, but no songwriting credit goes to Stevie because he wouldn't answer his damn phone calls.
You guys, that's such a mistake.
Oh, Stevie.
Well, but would we have had We Are the World, the one that we have, which is
we're going to hear in a minute, we would have had We Are the World with a lot of Swahili in it. We'll talk about that later, everyone.
So the song is very simple to learn because all of the choruses will be sung in unison. There are no parts to learn, just the melody, everybody singing the same thing. But if you recall, and what this documentary shows us in stark relief, is that there are numerous solos to divvy up amongst the 45 wildly different and presumably somewhat egocentric performers. And for that, Quincy calls in a vocal arranger named Tom Baylor. He is a white guy raised in a black church that Quincy met long ago. He always assumed he was black. And then they met face to face. He's like, "You're a white guy." And they become artistic brothers. So Tom Baylor puts every performer's name on an index card and he lays them all out on the floor. He has to decide which performer will deliver each line in their style, in their sound, and in their key. And they have to sell their style and their sound in not even a full line. Most of the solos are just half of a line with another artist finishing the line. So he has to match those artists up. Who goes with whom? And some of those pairings were really surprising. Yeah. And Dionne Warwick was like, "Why are you putting me with Willie Nelson? This makes no sense."
I know.
But Tom Baylor, he studied each and every performer. He went deep, analyzing their sound to create a synergy that would elevate the listening experience. He says, this is just so interesting to me. He says, for instance, Bruce Springsteen's sound was dirty. Mm-hmm. So he follows that up with Kenny Loggins, who had a very clean sound. Tina Turner was low and warm. So she gets paired with Steve Perry, whose range was very high and bright. Cyndi Lauper's vocal was very high and forceful. So she's bookended between Huey Lewis and Kim Carnes, who were more gravelly and laid back. And okay, I just got to circle back to Steve Perry for a minute, because we really get to hear a lot of Steve Perry's voice in this without Journey. Mm-hmm. Can we just devote a moment of appreciation to the yes. voice of Steve Perry?
Wow. I have written in my notes, literally in my notes, it says Steve Perry, nipple lightning upon nipple lightning upon nipple lightning.
I'm doing it right now. It's when he stripped down, you hear him isolated in this documentary in a way that you would never hear with him on stage. I mean, obviously he's out front and he's amazing, but to hear it stripped down like this, it's so high. It's so full of force and emotion. I remember my dad one time, he's a singer, right? But he doesn't know pop music that well. And he was watching a Journey video with Liam when he was like 5. And my dad was like, "Ouch, what?" Like what? This guy is like,
oh,
he couldn't, he couldn't believe how amazing that sound was and how difficult it mm-hmm. must have been to sing like that.
And I think during the documentary, I felt like the other artists were kind of in awe of it too. Like, yeah. you know, yeah. hearing him mm-hmm. do and looking and like, yeah, like that's something I noticed.
Yeah.
Okay, so I could spend the next hour taking you through all the incredible behind-the-scenes stories and a good deal of the drama that transpired that night between 11:30 p.m. and about 8 o'clock a.m. when many of the artists basically turned into kindergartners, you guys.
Yeah.
Unruly, impatient, they were tired, sweaty, and selfish. They were also unbelievably kind and supportive, many of them, not mm-hmm. all of them, many of them. But for that, you guys, you need to watch this documentary. I don't know if we've recommended it yet or not, but it's on Netflix, The Greatest Night in Pop. Okay. Instead, what I think we should do is I'm going to pick a handful of my favorite things that happened during the recording session. We can talk about them, and then you guys throw in other things that you sure. loved about, sure. because it's just chock full of goodness, you guys.
Yes.
Chock full. Okay, so one of the first things is like they're all arriving and congregating. It's like stars. They're just like us, right?
Yes.
Because many of these award-winning artists who you might think are like so self-assured and cocky almost, they're starstruck.
Yeah.
They're yes. like, "That's Bruce Springsteen."
Right.
They're looking around and it's like it's the most incredible cocktail party or high school reunion imaginable. And watching this doc, it truly feels like we are there.
Yeah.
Because you get to hear footage of just the way they're talking to each other, right? Like Cyndi Lauper says, this is current day Cyndi Lauper. So you guys, if you haven't seen it, they bring back some of the current stars. Like I told you already, Bruce Springsteen, we're going to see Huey Lewis. We're going to see Cyndi Lauper, obviously
Loggins.
Lionel Richie, Kenny Loggins. Yes. And Cyndi Lauper says, she remembers saying, "I felt like I was underdressed. I was worried." As they're getting situated on the risers, Kenny Loggins remembers Paul Simon looking up and going, whoa, if a bomb lands on this place, John Denver's back on top. Which begs the question, where was John Denver?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they said not being on We Are the World was one of the greatest heartbreaks of his life. He was not asked to be there, and he had done more for hunger relief than all of those people combined in that room. And he was not invited. But and he asked to be on it, and they said no.
Let's make sure Dan Aykroyd there.
Oh, God. And then there's Dan Aykroyd. But to your point, Michelle, when he said that, I didn't laugh. It's not funny.
Oh, no.
That is not funny.
My husband and I just looked at each other like, I don't like you.
I suddenly stopped liking Paul Simon.
It was such a dig at John Denver.
Do you think? Yeah. I mean, here's me, glass half full. I like Paul Simon.
I know.
I think at this point, John Denver, he's had his hits. Like, he wasn't probably at the AMAs. I would have to look it up to see if he was. They want star power of now. Mm-hmm. And so if all the star power of now is gone, who was the last big star before we were stars? Well, I guess that would be John Denver. So maybe it was a nice comment, right?
Like, nope. Nice try.
People like Diana Ross and stuff who were still big, but they weren't. 1985 is not really her heyday, is it?
Well, I would say that's when I saw her in concert. And I mean, she had a lot of stuff out then.
Well, I think most importantly, you combine it with the fact that he had worked so hard for hunger relief and that he wanted to be on it and he was told no. And then Paul Simon makes that comment. You combine those two things together, it makes it very unfunny. So maybe he didn't know those two things, but either way, he's making a dig at somebody who is no longer getting hits. And we'll guess he wanted to. Mm-hmm. We all recoiled, though.
Yeah. All right. So my first favorite thing I want to talk about is at around 1:30 a.m. after they've had to basically learn the song and get the chorus.
Hey, everybody. Let's pause here for station identification. Today's episode is brought to you in part by Hormone Harmony, a name that has so much more meaning to us now at the perfectly ripe ages of 55, 56, and 58. Longtime listeners know that the three of us are no strangers to hot flashes, night sweats, sleeplessness, and the occasional menopause moment, known more scientifically as menopause-related brain fog. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens that help the body adapt to stressors, including the chaotic hormonal shifts that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. Hormone Harmony has over 17,000 reviews online, and what you'll see them say over and over again is that they finally feel like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code PCPS at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use PCPS for 15% off today. Thanks so much to Hormone Harmony and thanks to you for listening today. Hey, everybody, a quick message. Today's episode is brought to you by Book of the Month, a monthly book subscription box that helps readers discover new books from up-and-coming authors.
The process of choosing your book is so easy and fun. Besides the website and app being really easy to navigate, the smaller but varied monthly selection, which always includes an anticipated new release, by the way, means I'm not overwhelmed with too many choices, and it's truly easy to make a decision. And let's be real, we're all about simplicity right now, aren't we?
Oh, definitely. So you guys, I was thrilled when I saw that this month's selections included a book I have been anticipating for over a year. I chose The Paradise Problem by Christina Loren. It is rom-com at its finest. Think Pretty Woman meets Succession.
Ooh. I chose Spitting Gold by Carmela Locus about two shady spirit mediums in 19th century Paris. I mean, come on, you had me at shady spirit mediums, right? This is a brand new hardcover book, and I'm getting it for less than I could get it anywhere else.
And great news, you can get your first book for only $5 using the code PETALS when you order at bookofthemonth.com. That's PETALS.
You guys, we love Book of the Month, and we know you will too. Hey, listeners, you know that feeling you get when you discover something amazing and all you want to do is tell everybody that you know about it? Well, that's exactly how I feel about Armoire. Armoire makes getting dressed super easy and super fun. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you get to build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, they're unique, and they're recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. Those styles show up to you in as little as 2 days. And then when you're ready for some new clothes, you just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. And that's exactly what I did a couple of months ago when Andy and I took a trip to Hawaii. And of course, I wanted to have some fun, beachy, cute clothes. Armoire was perfect for that. I got the most amazing outfits that I got so many compliments on. And the best part was that when we got home, all I had to do was ship those items back and they didn't have to take up space in my closet unused for a year. Right now, our listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/PCPS. That is armoire.style, armoire.style/PCPS to get up to 50% off your first month, and you'll never have to worry about what to wear again. So try Armoire today.
Recorded. And they're all really starting to feel the night and the time. Stevie Wonder decides he needs to be a cook in this kitchen. And so he decides they need to translate part of the song into Swahili.
And he's so, faking it. He's like going, God, and I don't mean this to insult anybody. I'm doing what Stevie Wonder is doing because he is also being insulting. He's like gobbledygook, 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 goopy dooby doo. And he thinks he's being
cue a lot of confused side-eyed looks and exasperation. Yeah. And I love someone actually yells out, they don't even speak Swahili in Ethiopia.
Yes. Yes. It's all insulting.
Bob Geldof's trying to talk him down because he's insistent. He's like, no, we need to stop. We need to translate
this. It's like 4 a.m.
Geldof reminds him, okay, listen, Stevie, we're talking to the people who've got the money to give. We're not talking to the famine, like suffering people in Ethiopia. And Waylon Jennings has had it. Waylon Jennings just walks down the risers and right out the door. And he says, good old boy, don't sing Swahili.
Which is also insulting. But it's but you understand the frustration.
Yes. Right. Yes, definitely. And everybody is just like sighing, like, are you kidding me? Ugh. And Huey Lewis says he remembers Ray Charles just saying, ring the bell, Quincy, ring the bell. Like, time for you to step up and do something.
It's so true. I mean, one of the things that I loved about that scene was, you know, it reminded me of like the student in your class, the professor would be getting ready to like let you out early. And then they'd be like, one more question. And you're just like, looking at your clock or your watch. And it's just so annoying. Mm-hmm. So there was that aspect. And then there was, at least what I picked up was, okay, this is Stevie Wonder talking. So like you said, Michelle, there are these rolling of the eyes, but nobody's really willing to say, I'm not doing that. It's like you needed the teacher to step in.
That's exactly
what Ray Charles was saying. Like, people aren't liking this, but they're not about to ring the bell, Quincy. And they're just kind of, you know.
Ring the bell. Yeah, I know. Everybody was uncomfortable. And Michael Jackson tries to turn it into a classic Michael Jackson sounding riff. And he tries to start doing like, and it's Smokey Robinson who finally takes charge because he starts arguing with Michael and he says, I've known Michael since he was 10. I can do this. I can get in his face. And he says, what the fuck does Shala Shalengay even mean? Literally says it. And you guys, there is video footage of this.
Yes.
What the fuck? And to his credit, they all kind of chuckle and whatever. But it isn't about this point in the night. They all kind of lose that star look.
Yeah.
And to us watching the documentary, they truly start to seem like an unruly and overtired bunch of kindergartners. Because some of them are being kind of bratty by now. And some of them are like crossing the arms.
And they're they're on the risers just like at school. Right? Yes. They're standing on the risers like they're at choir practice and somebody wants to sing their choir piece in Swahili and they don't know Swahili and they don't know where Swahili is.
And they're tired. And at one point someone says, and it's starting to get real ripe in here.
Yes.
Because there was hot.
Yes. They're all wearing their outfits from the AMAs still. Like Lionel Richie's still wearing his gold foil like suit.
And there's big lights. Anyway, it's pretty funny.
But they were so real. I mean, I just want to say in general, getting to watch this in this documentary, you know, that's kind of the first time we never saw these celebrities, unlike today, where you can kind of see somebody at their house. You know, this is what I'm having for breakfast. I'm Kristen Bell and I'm eating this and you're in their regular clothes. This was one of our first opportunities to see these people unscripted, you know, mingling, seeing them starstruck, all those things you said earlier, Michelle, and getting autographs, getting annoyed, being on the risers. I mean, they are. They're literally like kids in a choir, you know, practicing for a choir concert. They're just real people with the same kind of frustrations we all would have. And that was so, and they stink like, you know, yeah, we might have some BO under the lights.
They stink.
It's just so eye-opening. I love it because you also really get to see their true personalities come out.
Yeah.
They don't – yeah, there's cameras around, but, you know, they don't know that this is going to be shown for 39 years. I'm going to be dead by then.
They don't know this is history.
Yeah.
They have no idea that this is history. I learned – this was an aha moment for me, the Swahili part of it, because I'm a huge Stevie Wonder fan. I love Stevie Wonder. But when I went to the Stevie Wonder concert, I was like, make it end. Somebody please make it end. It went on. It was 4 hours, you guys. And it was just him riffing endlessly. It was like a jam in his basement. I'm like, you can't jam for 10,000 people. It was so self-indulgent.
Can I just tell you a really funny, though, piggybacking on that? We also get to see little scenes of them taking breaks. And I wrote this one down. Ray Charles is just riffing on the piano. He's just playing songs. And Ray all of a sudden goes, I've got to go to the bathroom. And Stevie goes, I'll show you where it is. And he grabs him by the arm to walk off and says, it's the blind, truly leading the blind. And all the stars just crack up.
Yeah.
But they truly
I'll
do
show
it.
You.
So, like I said, you get to see into their personalities and you get to see them have fun with each other.
It was great.
But here's a story, you guys, that made me mad and broke my heart a little bit.
I know what you're going to say.
So, it's well into the night. It's like 4 a.m. or something. And Sheila E. calls Prince to get him to come. And Lionel Richie and Kim Cragen, and they had all wanted Prince to be there.
He's been invited.
Oh, for sure. And they've actually saved a spot for him, a solo spot for him. And he's not there. And Sheila E. calls Prince and she tries to get him to come. And she says, I think you should come. It's pretty cool. Understand too, this is current day Sheila E. telling us this story. So this isn't hearsay or anything. This is coming straight from Sheila E.'s mouth.
Today. Yes.
Today. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Lionel gets on the phone with Prince, who I love this fact. He's at Carlos and Charlie's. Remember, it's 4 a.m. in L.A.
Yeah.
But Prince and his entourage are at Carlos and Charlie's, as you do, I guess, after the AMAs. And Prince says he'll come to play a guitar solo, but in another room by himself. Lionel is like, nope, I need you to come, and I need you to sing with all of us in one room. Plus, Quincy's like, we don't need a guitar on this. We don't, this, it's already been arranged, right? Music has been arranged. So Sheila E. tells us in present day that she was so honored to be asked to be in this group of artists, not to mention they asked her to sing a solo. She's a little put out, she said, at this point. She's a little put out that they keep asking her, can you get Prince here? Can you call him? Can you get Prince here? And she says, all of a sudden she realizes, hey, I think I'm being used for Prince. And she says, she starts to feel like the longer they keep me here, promising me this solo, maybe Prince will show up. And she knew he wouldn't. I think they're currently dating at this point, right? And she says, she knows he's not going to. There's too many people here. So she leaves. And it's heartbreaking because she says she knew then in her heart that they never intended her to sing a solo. It was just for her to get Prince there.
That was so heartbreaking because you can tell even in this moment, she wasn't bitter and she wasn't pointing fingers. She was very disappointed and her feelings were hurt. Mm-hmm. She's still on the record. She was still in the chorus, but she didn't get a solo. And so when she realized, I'm not getting this solo, that's when she turned around and she left. And she was one of those people that was the most starstruck. She was the
one. She couldn't believe that she was asked.
She couldn't believe it. And she's asking for everybody's autograph. And she's just so honored to be there. And then she realizes, they're just using me. And I felt so bad.
I did too. And also, can we say she looks amazing?
She's beautiful.
Current day, Sheila E. Holy cow.
She's quite beautiful.
So beautiful. So I was so sad and I was mad that they, because that's coming from her. It's not coming from Lionel. But at the same time, she kind of has the receipts to back that up, doesn't she?
Mm-hmm.
And the story. And I was like,
because they didn't give her a solo.
No.
They just kept, they were dangling in front of her like a carrot.
Yep.
And everybody else knew what their solo
was.
Well,
that was going to be Prince's solo. I mean, they were keeping a solo away.
But. Yeah.
And then you guys have alluded to this a couple of times already, but, and I know you're going to agree with me because maybe my favorite sneak peek into this whole night is when Diana Ross walks up to Daryl Hall with her sheet music in her hands, and she says to Daryl Hall, Diana Ross says to Daryl Hall, I'm your biggest fan. Oh, God. Will you sign my music? And all of a sudden, Lionel Richie says, you see Daryl Hall signing Diana Ross's music, and everybody's watching this. And then they all are like kids. They're like, great idea.
Mm-hmm.
And
mine.
All of a sudden, everybody's autographing each other's. And oh my gosh, Cyndi Lauper says she was just like, I couldn't believe these people were wanting me to sign their music. And it's so cute. And it's just, that was a really, just a really pure moment. I felt like,
that's that high school moment again, that, you know, they're on the risers and they have their music and it's like running around with their yearbooks.
Yes.
It was. Yeah, with the risers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So great.
Okay, so we need to talk about Bob Dylan because
I know
Bob Dylan and I have feelings about Bob Dylan too because I know there are a lot of people out there who love Bob Dylan. I'm going to come clean. I don't get it. Okay, everybody likes something different. I don't get Bob Dylan. So Bob Dylan is not he doesn't get it either.
No, he does not. From 11 p.m.
Yeah,
11 p.m. Bob Dylan doesn't get it. 8 a.m. Bob Dylan doesn't get
it. And poor, they've given him a solo, and you really actually have compassion for him. You really feel for him because he doesn't know how to sing his solo. And he literally does this.
You don't want to laugh, but you can't help but laugh.
Yeah, I know, you can't help
it. It's true. It's like, you ache, but you're like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I
mean, and he's terrified.
But you feel cringe for him too, don't you?
Do, yes, right. You do.
Because you feel like he knows he's out of place.
He knows. And it's not him trying to foist himself upon others with his musical style. He literally doesn't know what to do and feels that he doesn't have the chops to do what everybody else is doing. That's not what he does.
Exactly.
And all he's got is and so this is where Stevie comes into play and Stevie saves the day. He literally coaches Bob Dylan. He teaches Bob Dylan how to sing his part. And he went over to the piano and he like composed it and he's like, okay, like this. And Stevie Wonder is imitating Bob Dylan.
They say it was like Lionel says, all of a sudden, it's like he was speaking in tongues, like he was speaking voices. He was singing everybody's part in their in their voice. But that was so helpful, wasn't it?
It was so helpful. And he brought Bob Dylan out, and it's a great moment in the song.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is so great. And it reminds me when talking about my memories of first hearing the song and the video, I remember Bob Dylan, even in the video, just when they're all singing, he just seems so uncomfortable, even like he's barely singing. And I remember back in the 80s watching it and going like, why is he there? Like laughing and being, what is this? And now understanding the story more. And just like you said, having such compassion. I just, it was that secondhand embarrassment.
Yes, it was. Well, they do say they cleared the room. They said, when we're going to record this, we've got to clear the room. Quincy Jones knew. And they were kind of coaching him. You can talk it. Mm-hmm. And I love Quincy. He was going, like Bob Dylan would try to do his line. And you could see he almost had that look. And this is Bob Dylan. I mean, that look of kind of like, I don't think that's right. And Quincy was so supportive going, no, that's great. Yes, you can speak it. And you guys, if there's ever a good testament to what a good music mixer producer can do, watch this documentary and watch Bob Dylan sang his part with you can hear no background vocals, you can hear no background music, and you are kind of like, ooh, nails on a chalkboard almost, because that's not going with the rest of the song. And then listen to the completed song, and it sounds exactly right.
Sounds great.
It sounds great.
It's like the podcast. You wouldn't believe what this sounds like, you guys, before I put my magic on it.
It
and
is
when
so
I'm editing
true.
It, and then it flows together. And it I remember so the Huey Lewis Today, I think it was Huey Lewis, saying that Quincy Jones, just the role he was playing, had to be part psychiatrist or psychologist too. Like you had to understand what motivated people, what scared people, and create the climate and atmosphere that they could be their best. And that's a gift, no matter if you're a music producer or a human being, is just to know how to relate to people.
Yes, we're making, we're saving our own lives. That's true, we make a brighter day. Just you.
Okay, so I want to share a little bit about the scene where they are recording. It's that Willie Nelson, Dionne Warwick, Al Jarreau trio. And Dionne Warwick is the first of that trio to kind of sing her solo. And she starts to sing and she's like, what is that? And everyone's like, what is that? And there's like a something in her on her track or whatever coming in through her headphones. And they play around with stuff. And okay, she tries it again. It's still there. And she says something like, you know, I still hear the voice or something to that effect. And then I don't know, I just loved Kenny Rogers. He was like, well, could it be one of the mics? Like, you know, Kenny's trying to help save the day. No, the mics are checking out, all of that. Finally, she sings it and there's nothing there. I mean, it's fine. The track goes and somebody says, well, it's a mystery. And somebody says, oh, Ghostbusters, because we got Dan Aykroyd there. So they allude to that, or at least we've got our Ghostbusters. And here is my theory that I would like to share with you all. And I did some rabbit hole digging. And I believe this is going to be true. I believe that the voice that Dionne Warwick heard in the headphones was Karen Carpenter's.
I know.
Stop it right now.
We're just
at AM Studios, A&M Studios, where we know that that was the studios for the Carpenters. They were in Studio A for We Are the World. Studio B is where Karen and Richard did most of their recording.
So next door. Next door.
You guys, hair on the back. The back of my neck and my nostrils is at attention.
Well, and get this. I mean, Dionne and Karen were really good friends.
No.
Okay. Yes. Dionne wrote the foreword to one of the Karen biographies. I found some pictures of her at the funeral, Dionne Warwick at the funeral with Richard. They were very close. Dionne Warwick was the first to kind of record close to you. It never went out to the masses. But, you know, the Burt Bacharach connection, all of that. I am convinced 100% that one, Karen Carpenter would have been in that room had she been with us.
Hell yes.
And two, that was her. We know we have proof in quotation marks that her ghost roams the studios now.
There are reports. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I am convinced that was the voice. Nobody could explain what she was hearing, and then it was just gone.
I think you're right too.
And they troubleshoot like crazy. She's like, no, everybody stop. Everybody stop. There's a voice in my headphones and they're in they're at the soundboard and they're checking the mics. They are troubleshooting like crazy. And in the documentary, they never give you an answer. They felt it was important enough to include it in the documentary, but then it just disappears.
Yeah.
The problem, the voice in her headphones just disappears.
It just fixes. Yeah.
It just fixes. And nobody else hears it. They're like, what are you hearing, Dionne? She's like, it's a voice. Don't you hear it? Like, no, we don't hear anything.
I love knowing this. I love knowing that Karen spoke to Dionne.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They were, good friends. And that's if she was going to communicate through anyone, I think.
You need to reach out to Dionne and tell her this theory. Because I bet if she's never thought about that, I bet that would make her feel, is she dead or not?
Well, remember, does Dionne Warwick have like a 999 line? What are these colors? 1-900?
Yes.
Remember? Oh, she had like a psychic line.
She had a psychic thing,
yes,
I think.
She did.
She totally did.
Mm-hmm. What were those? 1976. Yes. 1976.
Yeah, you would see him at night. You would see him at night all the time.
Yeah,
that's right.
The Dionne Warwick psychic line.
Gosh, yeah. So I really truly believe that.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure.
And the scene and person I want to hold up as I love him more maybe than I even did before this is Bruce Springsteen. A couple things. First of all, yes, he can't. He never, you know, flies, as you said, the day after a tour ends. He's going to do that. They also share in the story that there was a big snowstorm that was potentially going to keep Bruce and Billy Joel from getting to the recording. So that was pins and needles. The universe somehow parted and they both were able to get there in time. So that was amazing. So we know Bruce Springsteen has been on tour. He's taken this red eye flight, gotten to LA in the recording. It's the middle of the night. He is the last person to leave that room. And he has the big solo in it that they record. Is it the very end of the song?
It's the very end of the song. Okay. And it's not just the solo. Then he's going to do all his little.
Right. Right. And he wants to get it right. It's so important to him to get it right.
That's like 7:30 a.m.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know how exhausted he must have been. And luckily, in this documentary, you get to hear present-day Bruce Springsteen reflect on this, too. And that's so special. So after seeing the effort he put into it, the patience, he had the patience of a saint, because you figure every time we're doing Swahili or we have to redo Al Jarreau because he's like,
oh my God, had eight bottles of wine.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, he's thinking, okay, add another 20 minutes on to the end of this. But he did it and he gave it his all. And he just.
And he was so good natured the whole time.
He was, wasn't
he? He was such a cheerleader of other people. He was so generous. And he never. There were a lot of people rolling their eyes that night for good reason.
Yeah.
He was not one of those people.
Exactly. And if anybody maybe had a good reason to roll their eyes, it could have been him thinking, you know, I'm the last one out of here. So the longer this takes, the longer I'm here.
Yeah.
But I never felt that either.
No.
And again, wanting to give 110% for that, for his solos and all of his raspy voice stuff. So,
well, and they say he says something like that, like by the end, he normally has a raspy voice, right?
Right.
But by the end of a tour and by the end of this long night, it's so bad. And he says, but he just gave it his all. And he's even like, and it sounded okay. And it sounded,
it's so and you bad. Guys, it's so sounds, good.
Yeah.
It's
so
iconic.
Good.
It's an iconic part of that song. I mean, I think if you tell people We Are the World, you know, remember it from the 80s. You can hear that gravelly Bruce Springsteen part of it as one of the first things that, at least for me, that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. I love you, Bruce. You're welcome on the podcast anytime.
For sure. We are the children. So let's not give it. There's a choice for me. It's a wrap. They know they have it. And you guys, Diana Ross is crying. She says, I don't want this to be over. It's like you said, it's like high school. It's like senior year, right? Mm-hmm. Those last few weeks are treacherous. They're torture. All you want to do is go home. You want it to be over. And then when it is, you don't want it to be over. Mm-hmm. And they all leave. Lionel Richie gets home and his family is congratulating him for his great job hosting the AMAs the night before. You guys, he won 6 awards that night.
He was hosting it and winning it.
And singing.
Yes. And singing. And
performing. The whole time, they say backstage. Well, and they say backstage, people would come up to him, oh, congratulations on that, you know, third award you just won. And they said he was laser focused backstage on notes and getting prepared for this night ahead of him. And one thing we didn't really say is, you know, we talked a little bit about Quincy Jones, but, you know, Lionel Richie, there's many parts in this documentary that it's very evident he has to be that kindergarten teacher.
That's
and
right.
He's so kind and so patient with everybody and calming everybody down and, you know, all the different egos that are in that room.
Yep.
Did we mention the sign that Quincy Jones hastily wrote and taped to the door? Leave your egos at the door. And at one point, Lionel says, they didn't. I don't think they did. But anyway, he gets home and his family is congratulating him. Oh, great job with the AMAs and all your awards. And he says he was like, what?
Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about? Because all he could talk about and think about was We Are the World. He says it overshadowed everything. And Huey Lewis, I love what he says at the end. And I think this is a great way to wrap it up. He says, we were exhausted, but we knew we'd done something that would live forever.
Well, it didn't just end after the recording ended, okay? We're putting this together. We are going to make a single of this that is going to raise money for hunger relief in Africa. So it is decided that the single will be released on March 7th, 1985, at the exact same time all around the world. You guys.
It's crazy.
I mean, let's just take a moment to think about that.
Logistics.
The coordination. All around the world. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. The coordination. Again, the universe at work here. Like, we have this moment that we can unify the whole world, and we're going to play it out like this. So we have this moment where everyone around the world is hearing it at the same time. It becomes the fastest selling single in U.S. history. We all go out and we buy the single, like, immediately. And you start seeing all these images on the news and, you know, MTV and everything of people all around the world singing it, you know, arm in arm, swaying on steps of churches in, you know, Main Street America. It's just, again, it's kind of nipple lightning upon nipple lightning, like you said earlier, Michelle, because you see all of these people together And I miss moments like this, you guys.
Yeah.
The unity that this song brought to the world, I'm not sure that anything like that can ever, ever happen again, okay? With all of the divisiveness we are living with today. I mean, logistically, it's probably the easiest it has ever been technologically and all of that technically to get something like this to happen with all of the abilities we have to communicate. And yet I think it's it will never, ever happen again. Those moments of people singing together, like I said, arm in arm, swaying and smiling, it was so moving and yet so bittersweet to me at the same time because I thought, we're not going to have that again. You know, I felt like we used to almost have it too during the Olympics and stuff. Those unifying moments, you know, I pray that it happens again for my grandkids and for myself, but, you know, I don't know that it ever will. So that I think is what makes this documentary coming out at this moment in time all the more important. Like, you know, the 80s had its issues. Yeah, we're quick to point those out. But yet, at the same time, there were some really special moments. And I think this was one of them. Like, we were able to leave all that differences aside and come together as a world.
Well, and part of that is because those were 45 people who were known to all the people. I'm not sure you could gather 45 people today that are known to all the people.
Well, yeah, there's that element to it.
Our culture doesn't operate that way anymore. We don't listen to the radio like that anymore.
It's just like TV shows. We've talked about that with award shows. You know, there's a reason the AMAs were more popular in 1985 because you knew, and more than one generation knew who all these people
were. Right.
They were people that we loved because we grew up listening to our moms and dads play their records, and they were still making stuff. And now, I don't even know if I would say my daughters in their 20s, if they watched the Grammys, if they would know who every single person was the way we knew who every single person was.
They would not.
There's
they
too
absolutely
many.
They would not. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because they exist in not a public space, right? They exist in – radio is public. Streaming is private.
Yes.
Right?
That's a good point.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. Well, so much good came out of We Are the World. Since its release – We Are the World has raised over $80 million, which is equivalent to approximately $160 million in 2024. They've raised that money for humanitarian causes in Africa, and they continue to raise money to this day.
We all knew that We Are the World was a big deal. We all knew it made a lot of money. We may or may not have bought the single, but what we didn't know was what it took to get that song made. It never even occurred to me that that might be a story in and of itself. This is a song I had fairly neutral feelings about, but I never will again.
Yeah.
Now I hear every one of those voices, and I know what it took to get that person in that place to sing that line in that way. And I'll never not hear it again. Thanks so much for listening today, and we'll see you next time. It's true, we make a better day,
just you and me, yeah. Today's episode was brought to you by Lionel, Stevie, Quincy, Bruce, Cindy, Diana. Do you guys love it when I do that? No, it was brought to you by some of our wonderful Patreon supporters and one-time donors, like our newest patrons, Rochelle, Mindy, Barbara, Scylla, and Tara, as well as Jill, Cheryl, Allison, and Cynthia.
In the meantime, let's raise our glasses for a toast, courtesy of the cast of Three's Company. Two good times.
Two happy days.
To Little House on the Prairie.
Cheers.
Cheers.
We are the world.
We are the children. And if you just believe, we're having a good time.
The information, opinions, and comments expressed on the Pop Culture Preservation Society podcast belong solely to Carolyn, the Crushologist, and Hello Newman, and are in no way representative of our employers or affiliates, and though we truly believe we are always right, there is always a first time. The PCPS is written, produced, and recorded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the fictional WJM Studios and our beloved Mary Richards. Nanu Nanu, keep on truckin', and may the force be with you.